Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I wish I was Justin Burke, but alas, I'm Sam Mazur, and with me is Dr. Brian Ward. Say hi, Brian.
Hello.
So our guests tonight are Drs. Weston Powell and Mackenzie Wyatt to discuss an approach to respiratory failure. But first, let's remind you about that show.
We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine. We have a fantastic conversation with our guests, Dr. Weston Powell and Dr. Mackenzie Wyatt. Dr. Powell received an MD-PhD from the University of California at Davis School of Medicine. He then completed his residency and chief residency in pediatrics at the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Hospital. He stayed on at Seattle Children's for sleep fellowship and then a pediatric pulmonary medicine fellowship, and is now fully graduated to attendinghood in Seattle, where he lives with his family. Mackenzie received her medical degree from the University of Kentucky College of Medicine and completed her residency at the Monroe Carroll Jr. Children's Hospital at Vanderbilt, where she received not one, but two advocacy awards. Dr. Wyatt is now a pediatric pulmonology fellow at Seattle Children's, where she can be found singing and playing ukulele. Today, Weston and Mackenzie teach us about respiratory schema, keeping our differentials broad, and utilizing the physical exam in a patient with respiratory distress.
So without further ado, let's get to it.
Hey, Sam, what did one lung say to the other?
Not sure, Brian.
We be lung together.
Wow, Brian, that was so funny. Hilarious. You are such a funny, smart, and handsome doctor.
Ah, thank you. Yeah, it's a good script. Yeah.
Great script. I don't know who wrote it.
No.
So hi, Dr. Powell. Hi, Dr. Wyatt. Thank you so much for coming on the show. First, because we're an informal group, is it okay if I ask if I can call you guys by your first name?
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. Go for it.
Perfect. All right. We have Mackenzie. We have Weston. We're ready to go. So let's start with some rapid fire questions to get you guys, to get our audience knowing you guys a little bit better. Weston, starting with you, would you mind giving us a one-liner to describe yourself? Kind of something that you're interested in outside of medicine, maybe.
So one thing that everybody learns about me very quickly is that I love the color orange. And so the one-liner for me would be that I'm a post-kindergarten 33rd grade student who loves the color orange, does the New York Times crossword with my wonderful wife, who's more brilliant in every way possible than I am, and together we raise two small children. And so in my spare time from all those things, I work as a pediatric pulmonary and sleep doctor here in Seattle.
Yes, that is definitely your side job. What should we know about orange? What should we know about... Brian already was laughing when you said orange, so it sounds like we should know something about orange.
I almost always am wearing something that's the color orange, and today it happens to be my shoes. But I have an orange jacket, orange backpack, orange sweaters, and I had once listed it as a hobby, and my wife Emily told me that that doesn't count as a hobby. It's a pathology instead.
Well, actually, I think it's very high visibility, so it's always good to find you. This actually is a little personal story, but my younger brother, you know how everyone had, and sorry about brand names here, those L.L. Bean backpacks when they were in school. And so my mom got my brother the bright orange one, and so we could always find him, which was always very, very useful because he was one of those kids that always walked left when everyone was supposed to walk right.
Mackenzie, I want to hear about your one-liner, and I really hope it includes a color. Not to set you up poorly.
Well, I'm Mackenzie. I'm a first-year Peds Pulm Fellow. I love music and singing and traveling. My favorite color is pink, but I am a Kentucky basketball fan, so
what a
big blue.
Silly, silly color.
I know. It's okay. We don't have to all be colors. I also don't really have a good color story either for myself, so I'm with you on that front. Is it okay if we guys ask you a little bit of other get-to-know-you questions? So one of the ones that we love asking is, what is your favorite failure and what did you think you learned from it?
My favorite failure is that I was such a bad t-ball player whenever I was a little kid. And there were five Mackenzies on the team and they would always tell us to run and we would just all go. And it was very bad. And so I was very bad at it.
Oh, always, yeah, always a good piece from the t-ball. I think as far as I know, I've certainly was one of those kids as well. We'll just put it that way. What about you, Weston? What do you got?
My favorite failure is our first year of marriage. I was planning meals, and I picked out a recipe that was going to be healthy. It looked great. And I read through it and I was like, it seems pretty simple. I'll go ahead and make this. And Emily, my wife, came home and saw what I was making and then asked me, what is the name of this? And it was lettuce soup. And literally the recipe was take a head of lettuce, put it in a blender, put some stock and a little bit of salt and blend it. And it tasted disgusting. I would not recommend it at all. And after many years of marriage, she still reminds me of this. And so whenever I pick a new recipe, I've learned to go ask her. And so, you know, from that, it's one of my favorite failures because one, it makes us laugh every time I cook something new, but also reminds me that seeking advice from somebody else is always a good thing to go do.
It reminds me of that children's book, The Stone Soup, where there's, you know, like a bunny rabbit village and they, but you took the whole second half of the book where all of the friends and villagers and everybody brings the things that actually make the soup what it is. You just forgot. It's like the printing press had an error that day and you just got the first two pages. So you've got a bowl of lettuce and maybe a rock on the bottom.
Yeah. And lettuce tastes like water. And so it was essentially just warm water in the soup.
I mean, the irony, though, is that you've gotten so much more out of it already than you would have from that single meal from a piece of soup, right? You got advice, you got ways to go look for help. I mean, you got everything right out of this piece. So, I mean, come on, this sounds like the best soup you ever made.
Exactly.
Would you mind telling us your advice? One of my favorite things to ask is, what is one piece of advice that stuck with you as a trainee, as a medical student, or even as a fellow or attending?
The thing that probably sticks with me the most is from the intro to medical school lecture, like the very first lecture, it was given by an internal medicine doc at UC Davis called Faith Fitzgerald. Dr. Fitzgerald came and talked to all of us. And she's famous in a lot of different arenas. And I think internal medicine folks tend to know her fairly well. And she wrote an opinion piece called Curiosity that I still like going back to. But she started off this lecture giving us advice on how do we succeed during medical school. And I've remembered this over the years, going through now 16 years of medical training. It's served me well. But she sat down and said, you're going to study hard the next 4 years. But remember, in the end, you're going to be physicians that are caring for people. And so the most important thing you need to do is go study those people. So if you get a chance, go out and live life like all your patients are going to go live life. So go to shows, go to movies, go do sports. And it stuck with me to remember that as we're going through everything we're doing, living that life is important, not just because it's good for us, but it helps us understand and relate to our patients more. And so when I talk to residents and med students now, that's often the advice I pass on to them. And because everybody feels overwhelmed studying, I remind them, like, actually, going and seeing that movie, reading that book, going to a Mariners game or whatever second-rate baseball team you might be rooting for. Then is a good thing because it helps you relate and be able to connect with your patients in a new way. And that in itself is a form of study.
Yeah, and I can see also how you've taken this to heart and given your in your one-liner that your pulmonology career was your hobby to go along with all the other important things. So we'll definitely walk away with this. And for all our listeners, all our trainees, all the way from even before medical school all the way through, you know, let's all take this as great advice.
Mackenzie, what about you? What is something that stuck with you recently?
Yeah, one of the things that somebody told me once that has really stuck with me is to always ask your patients at least one to two things that are not medical at all. And just remembering that you're a person and that they're a person, and it has just made things so, so much better.
That is straight out of Weston's article that he just referenced. I'll make sure I'll put that in the show notes because it's the Curiosity article, and that disposition of curiosity is such a great thing to have in medical training and in medical practice.
I love that article. It's such a cool story where she asked a patient that question and like, oh yeah, I had a broken arm. And you could just put that in as a broken arm. And then she asked, well, but how'd you break an arm? And the answer was, oh, I was in a boating accident. And then she said, well, what happened in the boating accident? And it turns out that the patient had been on the Titanic. And the boating accident was that she had it fractured as the Titanic was sinking.
Yeah. And there's a lot of, it sounds like, you know, as the theme from both of you guys, it's think a lot about humanity here and think about our patients as people and us as people too. We're all people and medicine will come second and that's really okay and we'll all be good. But I will say as a little bit of a segue, hey, Cribsetters listeners, we've been talking about Freed for the last few weeks and I thought I should give you a bit more of a background. So Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. We've kind of told you that part already. But what's new is the background. So Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Erez, selfishly, it would mean that he could spend more time with Gabby, who was spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, no extra mental burden. All of the magic happens in just a few clicks. So clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on what they do best. Most importantly, Freed is HIPAA compliant. It learns your style over time, just like any human scribe. At $99 per month, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. But good news, Cribsiders listeners, you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of the Cribsiders podcast can use code CRIB50 for $50 off their first month. That's code CRIB50 for $50 off that first month. As we are trying to make sure that, hey, we can know our patients and then we can also make sure that we are treating them appropriately from a medicine standpoint, we should probably get into a little bit of a case here. Brian, you wrote an excellent case, and I was wondering if you can start us off.
Yeah, we've got some people in Cashlack Children's Hospital. Weston, I'm going to start with you, put you back in intern year on the wards. It's 8 p.m. You're called to the bedside for, quote, breathing issues in a patient that was recently admitted. Miss Alice H. Violi. She goes by Al for short, is a 5-year-old with cerebral palsy and developmental delay, reactive airway disease, scoliosis, and a previous ICU admission about a year ago for hypoxemic respiratory failure. She was admitted earlier today for dehydration from probably a viral illness, but now it looks like her primary problem is changing to respiratory, and the nurse has called you to come to assess Al's breathing. So from this case to jumping all the way back to why we're here, would you walk us through your approach from a 30,000-foot level of respiratory failure?
Yeah. So this case is great. And I use, as we'll talk about, we use this what's called the compartments approach, which is really an anatomic basis for understanding the different pieces that put together to think through how do we assess a patient and then where do we go from there. And it's just one approach. And so I love using this because it's one of those. You mentioned, right, the patient had hypoxemic respiratory failure. So you can also take another approach and go hypoxemic versus hypercarbic. And that's a totally different system that you can use. There's other ways you can use into like a truly physiologic and do restrictive versus obstructive lung diseases and think through that. So those are all there. But what I love about this is that it's a great way at the bedside to start to assess a patient. And McKinsey is here as one of our pulmonary fellows, and we teach this here in Seattle because our former division head here at Seattle Children's, Dr. Greg Redding, wrote an article back in the 80s that used this approach, and then it has been taught over the years to different pulmonologists who've trained here. And so we use it to teach medical students, residents, fellows, and then we use it in our clinical practice. And it's a systematic way to think through the different anatomy that goes into breathing. And so that's what we're going to use. And that's, I think, what we're going to talk about here today. And so when we think about the compartments, you have to start and think about what are those. And so when I teach this, and when I use this, we're all reminded when you're called to a bedside and your heart rate is up and you're getting excited, what are you supposed to do first? Right? You take your own pulse before you take the patient's pulse. And I think when we're talking about breathing, the first thing you need to do is take a big, deep breath. So if we all pause, and for the listeners out there, right, whatever you're doing, take a deep breath and think about what's happening. So if we breathe in, hold it, and then breathe out. And so when I'm teaching this and when I'm at bedside, I start thinking through what needs to happen for that to start to occur. And so that's when we can start to think about the compartments. And so the first thing you needed to do was to hear that thought of let's take a breath or have the thought of take a breath. So you need to have a functioning central nervous system. And so that becomes the first compartment. So to receive that information and then send the signal to breathe. Then we can start to think about what's happening next as you're breathing in. And so we start to think about, okay, what are the muscles that are being engaged? And so we start to think about the muscles and the parts around it. So we have the diaphragm and the inspiratory muscles, and that starts to form what I end up calling the box, because it's all the musculature, both on inspiration, and then there's some muscles that we use on forced exhalation, although most exhalation is passive. So that's all the parts around it, and the diaphragm's moving and it's pulling down. And then we start to think, I trace the air, and we start to think about as you're breathing in, where is that air coming from? And it comes from outside the body, and it first starts to go through your nose, the back of your oropharynx, the back of your throat, and down into your trachea. And so that becomes the upper airway, so the first part of that. And so you have the upper airways, that part outside the thoracic inlet. We can talk later about why that's important, where that is. But the air starts going through that first part of the airway. And so you have the bear has to move through there. So that's the second or the third compartment. So we talked about the box. So you have the upper airway, and then it needs to come down and get through the lower airways and out through the conducting airways to where it's actually going to go to the gas exchange. So if you have an upper airway, and this is how we think about it, is if you have an upper, you have to have a lower. So you have an upper airway and then you have a lower airway. So you have the lower airways, and then it gets out to where the gas exchange is happening. And that becomes the meat of the lungs, or the parenchyma, we called it. So that's going to be the fourth compartment. So if you have the parenchyma, so then you have not just the alveoli where that gas exchange is happening, but the interstitium that's supporting those alveoli. And then the important thing about gas exchange is you need to have not only the airspace, but the blood going along with it. So all part of that parenchyma is going to be those three parts. And once you do that, you start to think about any one of those pieces could be impacted. And I forgot to mention, there's one more, that's the pleura, that negative space surrounding the lungs. And so you have the pleura there as well. And so when we start to that, you have that approach. And if you start to just take that breath, and take your own breath and think about the mechanics of what's happening and where are the different parts, then we can start to think through how these all start to happen. And when I teach this and when I think about this at the bedside, I start to think about, okay, where do those problems look like and how do we use this? And we can start to use the physical exam to start to tease that apart.
Awesome. So that's a great, great segment. And let me just make sure that that I can summarize this effectively and maybe ask some clarifying questions along the way. So it sounds like we start at the top. You have our CNS. We go down to our upper airway. We say our upper airway we must have a lower airway. The differentiation between that, where do you differentiate that officially? Is that the vocal cords? Is that higher? Is that lower? Is that in the trachea? Sorry, just to clarify that.
Yeah. So this gets into how do we at the bedside start to interrogate this, and it gets at kind of the work of breathing and where is, might there be collapse or problems happening. But it really ends up being the thoracic inlet. So right at the thoracic inlet starts to differentiate what's upper airway versus lower airway in this schema. So there is part below the vocal cords, that subglottis can be outside the thoracic inlet, but still be part of that upper airway.
Gotcha. I was just more for us non-pulmonologists, the thoracic inlet in and of itself as an anatomic definition is not something that I really know very well. So that's what you're saying. So really subglottis is kind of right below, and then that's where it kind of goes up. So I apologize for asking the same question, but thoracic inlet was not my forte.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm a lumper, so I lump them into these big categories. We could even get more granular. And as McKinsey's experienced that this compartments model, every one of us here in Seattle who uses it and has been trained to use it, we start to have slightly different flavors and ways to use it, because as you use it, you start to say, this is just one schema and I use it to be able to understand this patient in front of me. And as a result, how we understand that patient coalesces, but it also comes from slightly different flavors.
Right. And then we're also going to try to see at the end, maybe if we can combine the two thought processes together and see where we get. But so it sounds like CNS, upper airway, lower airway. We have our parenchyma, which includes both our alveoli and the blood vessels that supply it, the pleura, and then lastly, what you would call the box or the muscles, kind of the chest wall, the diaphragm, that type of thing. Does that sound like the appropriate compartments, or did I miss any of them?
No, those are the big compartments. And the box is one that I've come to mean because it's really the chest wall, it's the muscles that go into it, and then also it's the abdomen, and we have to not forget that the abdomen can impact our breathing. And so I think of it as everything around the lungs that needs to be there and need to be functioning properly for those muscles of inspiration, exhalation to work, and then that structure that you need as well to be able to create that negative pressure as we breathe in and out.
Perfect. Perfect. And so before we start to get into the nitty gritty here, and maybe this is both for McKenzie and for Weston, you know, so why is having a model like this helpful?
Yeah. So I think that coming into pulmonary fellowship can be so overwhelming, and it's really nice to be able to have this checklist for every single patient that you're running through, like, okay, which parts are involved, which area is involved. And I think just being able to not have it be so overwhelming and tying a lot of things together.
And I love it partially because we get to teach our fellows, and so they can learn it pretty quickly and take a really complex patient and start to think through it simply. But also for the medical student, right? Being called to bedside to assess breathing is one of the most terrifying things we can do. And having a system like this that then at the bedside you can start to use to break this down is great. And then the other piece that I love is it starts to overcome some of the biases of anchoring on any specific diagnoses. And instead, just asking, what's happening in this patient? What else could be happening? What else could be happening? And that's really what the compartments talk can really start to do, is start to ask, what else? What else? What else?
Awesome. And, you know, we try to also, you know, recognize bias a fair amount on this show, talk about disparities as well, which we'll probably talk about later on when we keep going. But this is a good point, as you said, to try to say, hey, look, if we just walk by compartment, we're not going to miss anything despite this, despite, you know, this person's background or anything like that, or whatever implicit biases we may have. So anyways, let's get into the nitty gritty. We've been kind of circling enough here. So let's really get into this case. Brian, would you mind continuing on?
Yeah, Weston, you finally caught the elevator to get back to Alveoli's bedside, and she is indeed, quote, breathing funny, which is probably what you would see in my physical exam from fourth year medical school, to be perfectly honest. What are you looking for as a pulmonologist on physical exam that can really help you determine what's going on? Would you mind telling us more about what breathing funny is, what work of breathing is?
And this is where I think about that physical exam being then tied directly to this compartments. And so starting to think about how do we integrate these two together, right? Because if the compartments are based on our anatomy, then maybe we can use the physical exam as we look at these different pieces of anatomy to put it together. And so I think about when you first get to the door, and because we're pediatricians and we're ending viral season, you're often, you know, putting on the gowns and the gloves, and you're standing there, and that's already when you've started your exam. So before you've ever like gone and laid hands on a patient or you've approached the patient, you're starting your physical exam, and your breathing exam is part of it. So from the door, you can start to get a sense of what's happening. And that from the door exam, I think, is so important, because if somebody's having a breathing problem, right from the door, you should be able to tell, are they breathing or not? And that starts to get at one of those key ones of that CNS. Is there a signal being sent to breathe? And if you're being called to bedside and somebody says, this person's breathing funny, and they're not breathing, then you probably have at least one of the compartments and the CNS compartment not functioning properly, because there's no signal being sent, take a breath. So from the door, you're doing an exam, that general exam, what do they look like? And for the breathing part is, are they breathing? Are they not? And then while you're gowning up, that time is starting to pass and you start to get a sense of what is their breathing like? Is it regular? Is it fast? Is it irregular? Is it what I would expect? Meaning kind of they're agitated or they seem upset, and so they're breathing fast, or everything else seems like it's going crazy, but their breathing's not, and that piece of it. And then you get to the bedside. And when I think about this for the physical exam, I think we often jump straight to our stethoscopes. And behind me, you can start to see, I think, my two-headed orange stethoscope hanging up back there. And so as a pulmonologist, I love our stethoscope, and we have two-headed ones that we like to use here in Seattle, so we can listen to different parts of the lungs simultaneously. And there's that auscultatory part of the physical exam. And everybody always jumps there when they're thinking about the physical exam for the pulmonary piece. But that visualization is going to be 80, 90% of what you're doing on physical exam to assess somebody's breathing. And so probably the most important thing you can do is start to unwrap them and look at their chest, look at how their chest is moving, and look at all the different muscles that are going into that breathing. So if we're thinking about the compartments, I talked about the CNS, right? You're asking, how's that signal coming and where is it going? And then we can start to assess the box. What does it look like around them? Is it a typically shaped chest? Is it deformed in some way? Meaning, you know, maybe there's massive rib fractures on one side, or it's sunken in, or maybe there's scoliosis and the spine is all twisted, so the chest wall is all twisted around and is not functioning normal. And that starts to be that how you start to assess the box is you start to look at what does it all look like. And from there, you start to then say, not just what does it look like, but how is it moving and what are they doing? And I think this is the part that if I could give a take home for anybody who's listening to this to think about how do you use this compartments is often when somebody says somebody's breathing funny, they're talking about work of breathing and they're saying somebody is using extra muscles to breathe and move air than what we would typically be expecting. And where the compartments really come in is, Sam, you asked earlier, where is that differentiation between upper and lower? Is using the compartments to start to ask and understand work of breathing as being not just work of breathing, but work of breathing that tells you where is that problem starting to come from. And the way I think about that is that you have work of breathing that happens when you're breathing in. So you have one set of muscles that you activate, your diaphragm and the inspiratory muscles, the external intercostals that you're starting to use to breathe in, to expand that chest, create that negative pressure so that air can move in. And if there's a problem on inhalation, that tends to come from the upper airway. It can come from the lower, but more often than not tends to come from the upper airway. And so if you look at a kid, and because we're all pediatricians practicing wherever you are, but let's say Pacific Northwest Cashlack Memorial Hospital, then you look at this kid and you look at their breathing and you say, oh, they're having a hard time. They're using all their muscles while they're breathing in, and then they can relax on the And as a result, you suddenly say, oh, that's probably an upper airway. And we can start to think about what is the physiology behind that. And that's because as you breathe in, you create that negative pressure in your chest. The negative pressure gets transmitted to your airways, which is then creating that pressure gradient for air to move down. But that's negative pressure in the airways, including a negative pressure inside the upper airway. And that negative pressure causes collapse. The differentiation from the lower airways is that negative pressure is pulling open those lower airways. So the lower airways are getting more open, and more open airways move air more easily. So on inhalation, the lower airways get better, but the upper airway gets worse. So if you have a problem in the upper airway, it's going to get worse on inspiration. The flip side of that is that as you look at this kid and they're able to take a breath in, and then you just see them crunch down, and they, for those of you who can see me, right? I'm squeezing my arms down. You can imagine a kid doing this, and they're squeezing their abdomen, and they're just trying to blow out as hard as they can, and not a whole lot of air is coming out. That starts to tell you, oh, that's probably more of a problem in the lower airway. So the big take home is using your physical exam to start to tease out the upper versus that lower airway. And that's all part of just looking at the kid and watching them and thinking about when during the respiratory cycle is this problem starting to happen. And this is also why I lump everything around the chest into the box, because that starts to be harder to differentiate on physical exam. And you can look and see, is there a problem like scoliosis, or are there just no chest wall muscles because of muscular dystrophy or some other problem like that. But it's harder to tease out, is there something in the pleural space on physical exam, because you just can't see it. And same thing with the parenchyma, that also starts to be harder. And that's where the compartments at the bedside starts to really help you with the where upper versus lower. And then if there's still unexplained something else, the parenchyma, the pleura, the box, then you can start to go down that road. Layering in, I think about layering in an obstructive process, meaning there's a problem moving air through, versus a restrictive process, meaning the lungs themselves have been shrunken in some way, either because the chest wall is shrunken, or the pleural space is filled, and so you've lost that lung, or the parenchyma is just filled, so there's massive atelectasis, or there's a massive pneumonia filling up. That's going to be more of a restrictive process where you just don't have as much lung volume. And so those are going to be the parenchyma pleura, and the restrictive process is going to make you tachypneic, but not necessarily work as hard to breathe. And so that's how we start to differentiate those.
So some clarifying questions here. It sounds like, this is fantastic. You walk in the door, you say, hey, am I breathing or am I not breathing? Thinking CNS right off the bat. Second thing, walk down and you say, hey, when am I increased work of breathing? Because we're all getting called for increased work of breathing. If it's on the inspiratory, we're thinking upper. If it's in the expiratory, we're thinking lower. And of course, it can always be both. But those are kind of the main pieces. Now, this is all doorway exam as far as I'm concerned, right? I could do this as long as someone took off the kid's shirt, I could do this from the door. Is there something on with your stethoscope that helps you differentiate between any of these other boxes or other compartments? Sorry.
That's where I think it's not just the work, but you start to listen for the sounds. And when are those sounds happening? Are they happening inspiration, expiration? That can be helpful. But that's why I say most of the exam is going to be helpful before you ever put that stethoscope on. And 80-90% of where you're getting is before you ever put that stethoscope on. And then you use your stethoscope to start to think about how is what I'm seeing incorporating with the sounds I'm hearing. And so if they're working really hard to breathe out and you start to hear more of a sound breathing out, again, that's helping you say, oh, it's probably more of a lower airways problem. I think often we think of the pulmonary exam as you put the stethoscope just on the chest. And Mackenzie can probably tell us, as she's watched all of us as attendings, we have our two-headed, and often we have one on the chest, and then the other one moving like all sorts of weird places on the kid's body. We'll put it on the side of the neck, we'll put it in front of their nose. And you're listening not just at the sounds inside the lung, but also that whole airway from nose all the way down inside the lungs to start to help figure out where is that turbulence coming from. And that's that localizing it anatomically that we start to then tie back to the compartments.
And we'll probably get into kind of our next steps or our next diagnostic tests in a little bit. So I actually want to save that because we're actually going to jump into some cases with each specific disease process. But before that, is there anything that I should be using in the room right now to kind of help me tell if this is going to be parenchymal or pleural? Is there anything, and you could say no, that's totally fine, and that we need to move to the next, but just like as we walk in, while we're talking about the physical exam right at this moment, is there anything that you can think of that we should say, hey, that's parenchymal, that's pleural, and that's box?
It's really hard to tease those apart just by physical exam. You can listen and you can start to say, oh, I hear dullness, or I don't hear breath sounds in this area. And that starts to think, oh, that part of the parenchyma, maybe it's filled with something. Or maybe that pleura is filled with something else, and so you can't get transmission of the air sounds. You can start to tease that apart. But again, one of the reasons I love this, using this compartments, is really to focus on that upper versus lower airway, and then use the compartments as you think through and say, okay, how might I interrogate? What other tests could I do to start to tease out pleura versus parenchyma? And at the bedside, you'll have a sense of, okay, I know these upper and lower airways are involved in some way because I have my physical exam starting to tease this apart, but maybe I need some of these ancillary testing to help me with things like parenchyma versus pleura. You can do percussion as well.
Awesome.
And so you can tap on the chest and see, is it hyper-resonant, meaning it's filled with air, but is that air trapped because the lung is full of air, or is it air that's filled the pleural space? And you just, it's hard to tease that apart just on physical exam. Now, I'm a young attending, so I don't have the experience to do that. And maybe one of my colleagues who's been doing this for 40 years would be able to, with confidence, say, but having trained with them and talked to them, they would all say, no, it's hard to do it bedside with a physical exam.
Yeah. And, you know, and also, like, look, you're talking to all, or most of our listeners are people who also haven't been practicing for 40 years. So I don't know if 40 years worth of experience is going to be the thing that we're all going to pull out right now to say, all right, I'm ready to rock and roll. But so, yeah. So, I mean, obviously it has to be patient specific. So let's actually just get into some patient specific cases where we can actually kind of fine tune some of those next diagnostic tests. So Brian, you want to take it away here?
Yeah, sure. Congratulations. You've now made it off the wards. You're in your continuity clinic and you see Declan K. Adron. They go by Deck, and Deck Adron is here for a sick visit. They're a 3-year-old previously healthy child who is here for noisy breathing. Mom feels like there's something stuck in Deck's, quote, breathing tube. She asks where you think the problem might be. I'm going to drill this because I think it seems so important. Remind us where that border between the upper and the lower airway is.
Although for CME reasons, we really should have called it Dex M.
Ephesone, I am so sorry.
Whereas Decadron. I'm just picking up on that now.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. This has nothing to do with the medicine. This is someone's name. This is Declan. Yeah.
So Declan. Or Dex.
Right.
So thinking back, the compartments at the bedside is where that inspiratory versus expiratory work really starts to come in to help differentiate that upper versus lower airways process. And so that border is the thoracic inlet, and that's because that's where, as you're breathing in, you generate negative pressure in your chest. And so the thoracic inlet, everything inside the chest is expanding and getting bigger. So all those airways, your trachea inside the chest, your main stem bronchi, those are the big airways. You have the medium-sized airway all the way down to those small airways that we think about it as being affected in a disease like asthma, they get expanded or pulled open as you're breathing in. And so air moves in more easily. And the flip side of that is that then when you're breathing out, those all get squeezed down a little bit and collapse down. And so it gets harder to breathe out. And so that's where that work of breathing starts to differentiate that. And so earlier you asked me, like, where is that differentiating? And so anatomically, we can say it's a thoracic inlet. I actually think physiologically is where it's going to be more important, and starting to use more of that physiologic definition of, okay, they're having problems breathing out. It's probably inside the chest somewhere versus that upper airway where they have problems breathing in. I'm a sleep doctor, so I also think about, you know, snoring and OSA as being the quintessential upper airway process, where you hear that noisy breathing as you're breathing in, and then it's really quiet breathing out. And that's because of that dynamic collapse of the upper airway.
I love that upper airway. You've mentioned in the past and offline, we were talking how much you love croup. I can't leave this stone unturned. Tell us why you love croup.
Yeah. To me, and so Sam, you're a med peds person, so you've experienced this. To me, croup is like the quintessential badass pediatrician diagnosis. And that's because as pediatricians, you see it relatively commonly. You get really comfortable with it. And so the kid can look like they're working like crazy, look like absolute garbage, and everybody else around them is freaking out. And if you're in an emergency room or somewhere else and there's adult providers around, one, because it's a kid, they're already, their blood pressure's up and they're freaking out. But you as a pediatrician get to walk in, look at the kid and be like, oh, I know what this is. I know what to do. And because you're a badass pediatrician, you know how to calm the kid down. And then as you calm the kid down, their breathing gets better. And that's one of the reasons I love croup. I also do research on circadian rhythms. And the other thing I love about croup, it always shows up at 10 o'clock to midnight, right? You think about all the times you've seen croup, it always shows up in the middle of the night. And yet it never shows up in the morning. I mean, it does, but pretty rarely. And what other disease has such like a time of day signature to it, where if I gave you an illness script of at 10 a.m. a kid comes in with stridor, you're like, huh, I'm going to get an x-ray. I'm going to, you know, call ENT to bronch this kid to look for something else. Whereas if I get that same illness script at 10 p.m., a kid comes in with stridor, you're ordering the dexamethasone and steroids and everything else to treat this croup. And that's one of the other reasons I love croup so much. But mostly I love it because as a pediatrician, it's one of those diagnoses that is pediatric specific and makes you feel like this just amazing pediatrician because you know what's going on. You know how to make the kid better. And they, and most often they do get better.
It's a great one. It's a very satisfying diagnosis. I have one other clarifying question. We've talked a lot about this upper versus lower airway distinction. Would you help me discern the difference between a lower airway and parenchyma? And when we're talking parenchyma, is that really only the alveoli and then everything above that is lower airway, or do you have a different way of thinking about it?
Yeah. I mean, this is where the compartments can start to break down a little bit because there is some blurring of that line. And where is that line starting to be? And so if you think about it from the physiologic basis of the airways are, you know, collapsing on exhalation or getting smaller on exhalation, so they have that expiratory work, that's going to be that lower airways process. Now, a lower airways process, because maybe that airway gets mucus plugged, can then cause a parenchyma process with that atelectasis behind it. So they do get blurred and mixed in between. But if you're thinking about it in terms of just using it to think about where might this problem be, then that's where you start to do it. And so that's why I draw that line between, is it the role of this part of the anatomy for moving air, or is the role for this for gas exchange? And if you have it filled or not functioning properly, that gas exchange isn't happening as you would expect. But actually, in reality, there's blurring at the borders of all these.
So if we take it to Declan's case for a second, you know, we say, hey, this is a kid where we're talking upper versus lower airway. We're saying, hey, this kid is really sucking it in on the inspiration, has subcostal and intercostal retractions during that. And you're saying, hey, I'm confident this is upper airway. Now, as we kind of move forward, now that we're in our first compartment of upper airway, is there anything that you would do from a compartment standpoint that we should know about? Or is it going to go back to our normal differential diagnosis and saying, hey, does this kid also have a barky cough? Does this kid also, is it also, as you mentioned, 10 p.m.? Is it also kind of our classic illness script there? Or is there anything else we need to start thinking about now that we've entered the upper airway box?
Yeah, I think that's where you start to use that upper airway to say, like, what is my differential for problems of the upper airway? And then you add in these other things to start to tease that out. And that's where you can start to do, you know, you do the things where you listen and you say, is it more in the nose? Is it the back of the throat? Is it a little lower? You can start to do that, but you're just using that compartment to break things down and build your differential for that compartment and what might be going on there.
Perfect. Perfect. That makes sense. Okay. So we're using our compartments to kind of put us in and also really to slow our pulse, as you kind of had mentioned, right? We say, okay, the only thing at least I know right now is that I know this is an upper airway problem. So now I can just, like, you've gotten one step closer. Now I can think with a little bit part of my rational brain. So I actually really like that because, again, as you walk into those first decompensating patients, you're like, ah, heart, lungs,
yeah,
brain, everything. And so this is that's where the real helpful piece is. Okay. Awesome. So that's upper airway for us. Brian, what else we got?
Let's mix it up. I won't spill the case too soon. I will bring you both, Mackenzie and Weston, to the ICU. You're now second year resident. Congratulations. You're off the wards. One of your patients is an adolescent who is an unrestrained passenger in a motor vehicle collision. He was admitted for polytrauma, and on day one of hospitalization, he's now on 2 liters of oxygen, and his saturations have been going a bit down over time. You've checked the blood gas, and his CO2 is elevated. He's intermittently becoming more tachypneic. His breathing is becoming more labored, and he seems to be in more distress. Again, you and your team are concerned about his breathing. How can the compartments help you work through his differential diagnosis?
Yeah, and so like I said earlier, some of our patients are so complicated and so complex. And so breaking it down to see what parts of the compartments are involved and then what can we do about it as well. So I just walked down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 for our compartments. So thinking first with our CNS, so our brain. So I'll sit and watch them and say, okay, how often are they breathing? Are they taking really long pauses and we're not seeing them take a breath as early as I would expect? Then I'll look at like their med list and see, okay, are they on opiates? Like, have they in their history, you know, have they had head trauma in this ICU patient? I'll also like sometimes press on their diaphragm to see, okay, maybe I can't see it because they're a bigger person, which is definitely one of the limitations of the physical exam and the compartment model, but I can press on their diaphragm and see, like, okay, does it seem like they actually are taking a breath and I can't see it? Then I'll move to my upper airway and I'll look to see, okay, do I see any inspiratory work? So do I see those tracheal pulling? Do I see the nose flaring or the head bobbing? And do I hear that inspiratory sound? And so I'll look to see if there's any facial trauma, like in the nose. Does it look like they're really collapsing in their upper airway? And because I'm a singer, I think about pitch a lot. And so sometimes I'll think about the upper airway because it's that shorter tube. Sometimes we'll have a higher pitch sound. So that's drier than sometimes not whenever it's blocking with the tonsils, but sometimes I'll just listen for that as well. Then I'll move down into the lower airways to see, okay, do they have a lot of secretions? And then I'll actually press on their belly because I'm not as good at telling inspiratory or expiratory work. And I'll actually try to feel if they're pressing their belly out while they're breathing out. And so feeling for it can really help me. And then sometimes I'll listen to hear, okay, like with the upper airway, you have that higher pitch sound. Sometimes I'll listen to see, okay, is this in the expiratory phase? Is that lower pitch sound? So you'll think about wheezes where it's like a hmm instead of the the higher pitch noise versus the lower. So I'll see, is there any secretions? Did they have a history of aspiration? Did by any chance they have any history of like asthma? And then how are they being fed? So is it post-pyloric feeds or is it before? So are they, you know, getting some of those feeds into their airway? And then I start to think about the parenchyma, and that's a little bit harder to tell, but like Weston, you know, I'll look at the monitor and see, okay, how fast do they seem like they're breathing? And then I'll watch them and see, are they breathing fast? Are they having tachypnea? Because if you are decreasing your tidal volume, you're going to increase your respiratory rate to keep up that ventilation. And then I'll start to think about, okay, what can my alveoli fill with? So water, pus, or blood. So for our patients, thinking more about collapse, so atelectasis or pleural, like pulmonary edema. And then thinking about the vasculature. So was there any cardiac injury that could have led to pulmonary hypertension? We don't see the interstitium as much in our patients, but, you know, in other patients, you know, you can start to think about fibrosis. Listening for crackles is something that I'll do because I think about the alveoli kind of popping open to make those noises. And then thinking about looking at their fluid balance. So, okay, like, are they really, really puffy? Like, do their eyes look puffy? Like, do their hands look puffy? And that can give us a clue of, you know, maybe there's a little bit more pulmonary edema in that interstitium. And then the pleura, you know, thinking about, okay, does it seem like it's dull? Does it seem like there's this decreased sound? Did they have something concerning that, you know, you should think about a hemothorax and pneumothorax and how big is it? And then thinking about the box in these patients. So thinking about, okay, this patient was injured, looking at their chest, are there any injuries around that area? Like, does it look like there could be rib fractures? Looking at how big their belly is, thinking about how recently they pooped and thinking about constipation, especially if they're on a lot of opiates, that can lead to challenges breathing in. So I'll start to look to see if, you know, there seems to be any restriction from that area.
And this is quite the differential, right? We kind of gave you someone who is very open entirely, who is probably has multiple things going on, to be honest with you. I actually was about to ask a question, but I just want to make sure before I do that, sorry, if Weston, if you wanted to jump in and add anything to that puzzle before I kind of ask my next layer question.
Now, Mackenzie did a great job kind of walking through each compartment and using that to then guide that differential for that compartment and thinking about what is she looking for at those different parts that can feed into that differential. And that's exactly what the compartments model is geared to do. Because it would be easy in a trauma patient like this to just jump straight to the x-ray, see some whiteout, and say that explains everything. But then you might have missed some CNS compromise, or you might have missed how the stomach was really big and that was contributing to this. But if you take this systematic approach, just like Mackenzie just did, and think about each of those parts and think through what could be going on in this patient, what am I seeing in this patient in front of me, then you can start to pull out and start to say, oh, yeah, this is what is going on in this patient. and it might be 8 different things. And that's okay, because we're all allowed to have more than one problem. And if you do that, then you start to think about, okay, what are those, as McKinsey was starting to do, think about what are those things that I can address? What are the things that I haven't fully answered or my physical exam can't fully answer? The pleura space, or maybe the looking for that adolescence. That's where secondary testing like an x-ray or something else can start to be useful to layer on top of this. And then we can use that to refine that differential and think through it. And that's what the compartments are built to do.
Perfect. Yeah, that's actually perfect. I apologize, McKenzie, for about to ask you a question. I jumped over to Weston, but he actually perfectly segued what I was going to ask, which is, let's just talk a little bit more about secondary diagnostic testing, right? So our first, when we walk into the patient's room, we did our physical exam. We have our history. Our physical exam gives us, is essentially a diagnostic test, giving us a pretest and a post-test probability. And we lead, when we're done with this, with like 4 or 5 compartments, right, that we just talked about that have, hey, this is on my differential. Are there any specific tests that you get that we should know about from a compartment standpoint in the way you view this piece of the puzzle, rather than our generic, hey, I see hypoxemia and therefore I'm going to get a x-ray?
I think always remembering to get the blood gas, because that's something that we'll forget a lot. We think about the lungs and it has 2 jobs. It has a lot of jobs, but you know, the gas exchange part is the oxygen and the carbon dioxide, and that's something that I will see like a lot of interns or medical students forget to do. And so just because you don't see the oxygen levels going down, or because you already have a hypoxemic patient, doesn't mean that your CO2 is normal. So making sure to get that. And thankfully, whenever we walked into the ICU room, they had already gotten that blood gas. But I think that's one of the key things.
And then let me ask a follow-up question to actually, while we're talking about blood gas, while we're talking about blood gas and hypoxemia, are there any compartments that are excluded if you have, for example, hypoxemia? Any compartments excluded if you have hypercarbia?
No. I mean, that's why I said this is one schema, and any one of these can feed into a hypoxemic respiratory failure or into a hypercarbic respiratory failure. And instead, what this is just a parallel approach that we like to use, because it's built on the physical exam and it's built on thinking about that anatomy, and lets you kind of bucket your differential diagnosis just like McKinsey did for this patient.
Okay, so our differential still remains broad kind of as we walk in, regardless if the patient's desatting or, as you said, about the blood gas component. Are there any tests that you would recommend us getting off the bat that would help differentiate between any of the compartments that we should think about, other than, again, using our old schema to kind of look at certain types of disease processes?
Yeah, I think getting a chest x-ray, and as pulmonologists, we really love the 2-view chest x-ray, especially to evaluate for the box. And that was something that I didn't appreciate as much as a resident, but really noticing that diaphragm and seeing if it's flattened or not can really help distinguish lower airway also from upper airway. And being able to see, is that really a pneumonia or is it more atelectasis because it looks more collapsed?
Yeah. Any tips that we should, you know, the pulmonologist, we essentially have a pulmonology consult right here for our patient who is essentially, you know, multi-compartment respiratory failure there. Yeah. Other than there's the tips on the x-ray, any other tips that we should kind of be thinking about as we're kind of walking through this compartment situation?
I think of, don't get the x-ray just because the patient's hypoxemic, but instead use the compartments to help work your way through that x-ray and think about what are you seeing on that x-ray that can fit with the anatomy that you're using in the compartments model. So you're looking at the trachea, so you're looking at the major airway, and you're looking at the main stem bronchi and seeing how they look. You look at the lung fields to start to assess the parenchyma and how do those look and are they normal or abnormal. As McKinsey brought up, that 2-view x-ray we love, because that lateral view can really tell you, is there hyperinflation? Is there chest or is there air behind the sternum? Are the diaphragms flattened to suggest that air can't get out? And if air can't get out, that's again pointing to that lower airways process and helping fit that in. And so you're looking at all those things, but now you're starting to think about how does that the anatomy you're seeing on the x-ray fit into these compartments. And the pleural space, really one of the only ways you can assess it is with an x-ray or other kind of imaging, because that physical exam isn't great at starting to differentiate that. And so that's, again, what you're doing. You're looking for that pneumothorax. You're looking for something having filled that. Because right, in a typical patient, the pleura should be this potential space. And if it's not, then that's where you start to have compromise in that compartment. And so that's why I think of the x-ray. You've done your physical exam and you already started to stratify and build your differential for these different compartments. And then that x-ray takes that to the next level and you start to then refine that differential as well. And that's what all testing we should do is start to be able to refine our differential from the beginning.
Amazing. Amazing. All right. Awesome. So we just talked about how the compartments are very useful from a differential diagnostics place, how we're not going to hopefully be biased and we're not going to miss anything just because, for example, we see a whiteout on the x-ray. I'm also wondering if the compartments can be very useful for treatment purposes. Are there any specific medicines you'd recommend using, for example, or anyone you'd recommend calling, depending on which compartment you find involved?
Yeah, so I go down my list again whenever I'm thinking about it. So CNS, thinking about what medicines we're on, talking to our pharmacist, maybe getting head imaging, maybe talking to the neurologist instead. Our second one for upper airway, trying to call ENT instead, possibly. Or if it's something like croup, you know, giving things to help relieve that inflammation. Or if you think that there's something like a foreign body in that upper airway. The lower airway is where I think that the pulmonologists are really, really helpful for, because that's things like secretions and airway clearance, aspiration, maybe you should get a video swallow study, but it's also things like asthma as well. So that's why our bronchodilators can be really helpful, or our inhaled corticosteroids, or changing where we're feeding a patient. And then with parenchyma, you know, thinking about, do we get imaging like we talked about already, but then, you know, water, pus, blood are the three things that can fill it. So do we need to treat with antibiotics, or do we need to give it more time? And then vasculature, thinking about getting echoes and talking to our pulmonary hypertension specialists, if that's cardiology or pulmonology in your hospital. And then I should have mentioned with parenchyma as well, thinking about your fluid balance. So thinking about, you know, with the water piece, do we need to give Lasix to get some of that fluid off? And then the box, thinking about, do we need to give constipation meds, or do we need to talk to our orthopedic surgeons about scoliosis and different things that can be modified as well.
And then the pleura, how do you evacuate?
Pleura, talking to surgery colleagues or the emergency med or IR, trying to get rid of that air or the blood to get rid of that space, or if we should just wait on it.
So in your case, you've really defined what is multi-compartment respiratory failure, how we have all of these things going on, how we have many things that we can do. And even though we're seeing a complex patient and it feels like we're throwing medications at them, we're actually doing it in a systematic way, rather. So in evaluating your patient, you optimize multimodal pain management and reduce opioid-induced respiratory depression. An interval chest x-ray showed some atelectasis, and so you start some airway clearance, help recruit the lungs, maybe get the patient up and walking, and use some help from our colleagues in physical therapy or occupational therapy. There are no rib fractures and no interval development of a pneumothorax and hemothorax, and surgery is already involved in this case, was happy to find that out. And lastly, you begin a PICU classic, an aggressive bowel regimen to reduce abdominal competition.
I love that last one, because there's patients we definitely think of as having life-threatening constipation, where just a little bit of compromise in the abdominal compartment can start to affect everything else. And so we don't often think of treating constipation as being life-saving, but it can be in certain patients.
So excellent. I mean, we just treated our patient. They're clearly getting a lot better, and great, great work. So I think we're reaching the end of our time here. So thank you so much for being with us. Before we get there, we like to talk a little bit about take-home points, kind of big summaries, anything that you think our listeners should kind of walk away with here as we're talking about respiratory failure from a specific modality. Maybe Mackenzie, we'll start with you. I can point in the right direction and then Weston can take it home.
I think just really honing in on your physical exam, because I feel like that's something that has helped my assessment just exponentially. And just making sure every single time you go into the room, you're thinking about, what am I looking for? Because if you don't, you're going to miss it.
I agree with having that system so that you can think through every different part. And that's why we love the compartments model and teaching it to people as a way to do it. And I think the real take home from the compartments model is as you're at that bedside, thinking about that work of breathing, not just to say work of breathing, but does it work while they're breathing in or work while they're breathing out? Because that starts to be one of the key differentiators to start to localize either to that upper airway or to that lower airway. And that then takes you down two different paths of calling either colleagues to look at that upper airway, treat something up there, or calling pulmonary to start to think about that lower airway. And then the box, and just thinking about everything else outside and around the lungs and how that impacts it. The abdomen being a big piece of that, but the muscles, the chest wall, all those need to be working in concert for breathing to be functioning. And so while we think of the lungs as being inside there, that box around it is just as important. And that's where the compartments really help you think about that piece of it as well.
Fantastic. Amazing. Thank you both. As we close, is there anything else that you'd like to plug, anything that you want us to look at, or any articles outside of that one curiosity that you mentioned at the beginning, Weston, that you'd like us to read? Mackenzie has nothing to plug.
So I think the curiosity, it's such a great reminder to go and talk to our patients and find out. And for me, the big plug is remember that being in this job and taking care of patients, right? It's such an incredible privilege to hear about that. And in pediatrics, I think it's even more fun to do that because not only do you get the concrete answers of they read this book or saw this TV show, but if you talk to your patients, they are so creative and think of all these different things. And, you know, being in pediatrics is not the joy of what we do, is get to hearing about those things from our patients. And if I really had to plug one thing, I would say go home and sleep. And as a sleep doctor, it's great. So give yourself 8 to 9 hours because nothing makes you feel better than a good night's sleep.
I think that's a very important plug. Everybody, go do sleep as the website of choice. All right. Thank you guys so much for coming on. Our expert pulmonologist here talking to us about the differential diagnosis for respiratory distress. So thank you. Thank you again.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producers for this episode, Brian Ward and Mackenzie Wyatt, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I have not been Justin Lee Burke. Instead, I am Sam Mazur.
I have not been Chris Chu. I am Brian Ward.
It's very complicated over here, but thank you, and good night.